Hello there. Today is Wednesday, September 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a major announcement that could impact the rest of Donald Trump's presidency. The UK Supreme Court overturns a plan by the new prime minister to shut down parliament.
If we allow a president to get away with shredding the United States Constitution, that will last forever.
So ahead, the lyricist behind the Grateful Dead's poetic music has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it official Tuesday, telling fellow Democrats she supports a formal impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump.
I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. I'm directing our six committees to proceed with their investigations under that umbrella of impeachment inquiry. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
Well, Pelosi said reports indicating that President Trump pressured Ukraine's leader to investigate Joe Biden's family was a betrayal of our national security and a betrayal of our election process. Trump insists he did nothing wrong when it comes to Ukraine and announced he will release a transcript of a phone call with the Ukrainian president.
And this week, the president has admitted to asking the president of Ukraine to take actions which would benefit him politically. The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections.
Pushing back, the president denied threatening the Ukraine leader and that he would withhold U.S. financial aid approved by Congress in assisting that country's ability to fight Russian aggression.
I did not make a statement that you have to do this or I'm not going to give you aid. I wouldn't do that.
Former Vice President Joe Biden also weighed in Tuesday, saying that he knew if he decided to run for president that Donald Trump would attack him. But he said that an American president pursuing the leader of another nation to investigate a political opponent crosses the line.
We have made the experiment of self-government work. We've always been a beacon to other countries around the world. We know who Donald Trump is. It's time to let the world know who we are.
The GOP-controlled Senate, meanwhile, has approved a non-binding but symbolically important resolution calling on the Trump administration to immediately provide the House and Senate Intelligence Committees a copy of a whistleblower complaint involving Trump. Joining us to talk more about all of the latest developments is criminal defense attorney and former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice. Jack, this issue really happened so quickly, unlike the years-long Russia investigation, which did not have the support for impeaching the president. So what is different this time?
The reason that this is different is because it's simple. Very simply, the president of the United States picked up the phone, called the Ukrainian president, and said, "We want you to help us go after one of my political adversaries." That's not something a president has ever done, and you can't justify it. That's something that people understand viscerally, and it's something that I think may very well cross party lines. So you may actually see Republicans, instead of backing away, sort of grudgingly acknowledging that that's true.
Now, you're hearing a lot of talk about the president putting national security at risk. Can you explain why that would be?
First of all, anytime you go to a foreign adversary trying to get them to do something, you open yourself up to blackmail. That's one of the first problems that you face. The second problem that you face is when you expose some of the other information that you might have, some of the other intelligence that you might have, you may be, and this president has done this in the past, exposed our intelligence to foreign nationals. And so that's a separate question that worries me. This is reminiscent in some ways to me of some of the intelligence that the president disclosed to the Russians in the Oval Office. I think about that issue, and I look at this issue especially from the perspective of somebody who used to recruit foreign agents and the effort that we needed and continue to need to go through to make sure that we protect who they are and the intelligence information that we acquire as a result.
How much trouble could the president be in for something like this, and what does it mean to launch an impeachment inquiry? Is that the same as impeaching a president?
It's on the front end of the impeachment process. Really, it's the investigation itself to determine whether or not they should actually go towards articles of impeachment itself. Essentially, the House does this investigation. It is their constitutional obligation, and our founding fathers actually made this and put this into the Constitution itself. They then have to decide by a majority whether or not they will move this to the Senate to actually have a trial. What would then happen is that two-thirds of the Senate, a supermajority, if you will, would have to conclude that impeachment is appropriate. Now, we have to look at the history of the United States. Never gone to the step where the Senate has actually found somebody essentially guilty of this. We had three instances. One of those was Richard Nixon. He quit. We had two other presidents, Johnson and Bill Clinton. Impeachment was found by the House, but they were never convicted in the Senate. So we've never actually had it go that far.
What about other people involved in this potential scandal that may have been a party to it or known about it and didn't say something or help the president keep it from going public or getting to Congress?
What the president and his supporters have been arguing is that this wasn't a quid pro quo. Yes, the president made the call, but he never held back the $390 million that was supposed to go to the Ukrainians. The thing is the standard isn't the money. The real problem in the first place was actually picking up the phone and saying, I want you to help me go after a political adversary. And the problem is that the president has already acknowledged that that's the case. What we are seeing right now is a White House that is backpedaling quickly. And they're backpedaling in a way we never saw during the Mueller report. In fact, what we're seeing right now is not only is the White House going to release the transcript, it appears that the whistleblower in this case may very well be able to appear before Congress to testify. They're going to try to be as transparent as possible to try to shut this down. And I think one of the reasons they're doing that is because they recognize calling a foreign government and saying, help me go after a political adversary is a very serious political problem. And if they don't find a way to fix this, they may have trouble, not just for themselves, but what this could do to the Republican Party, which, by the way, sort of creates a domino effect with Republicans. What we're also seeing right now in the Beltway is this, is there are a lot of moderate Democrats who are holding back on the impeachment issue, even when it comes to the Mueller question. And these are Democrats who actually won in predominantly Republican districts who are now coming forward saying, this one is different. And when you look at what Pelosi has been trying to do in the first place, is trying to hold on to those districts. The fact that she is coming out saying, we're going to move forward with this issue, that really says something about where the Democrats are. But honestly, this says something about what the problem is and what this president did. This is actually different and relatively simple to address, and they have it on tape. That's what makes this different.
All right. That is criminal defense attorney and former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice. President Trump delivered his scheduled speech at the UN General Assembly in New York Tuesday, where he gave some a chance to see his anti-globalist message while calling for religious freedom worldwide. Trump also blasted Iran over its alleged recent attacks on Saudi oil facilities, but indicated he's open to talks with Tehran. White House correspondent Patsy Wudukuswara has more.
It's President Trump's third speech at the United Nations, and this is his main message to world leaders.
The future does not belong to globalists. The future belongs to patriots.
Also part of his message, his America First doctrine and his criticism of China over the ongoing tariff war.
I will not accept a bad deal for the American people.
Trump also stressed issues of gender equality, an initiative led by his daughter Ivanka, and religious freedom, his administration's focus at UNGA this year.
Americans will never fire or tire in our effort to defend and promote freedom of worship and religion.
A contrast to his 2018 speech.
The United States will not tell you how to live or work or worship.
A difference noted by Richard Gowan, the UN director at the International Crisis Group.
He likes talking about sovereignty because he wants to defend American sovereignty, but he also likes talking about religious issues because that does play very well with a lot of Republican voters. And I don't think he's that worried about the contradiction.
Trump spent a substantial amount of time in his more than 30-minute speech on Iran. The U.S. accuses Tehran of recent attacks on a Saudi oil facility. But despite the sharp words, Trump is sticking to sanctions and showing restraint.
It is time for Iran's leaders to finally put the Iranian people first. America is ready to embrace friendship with all who genuinely seek peace and respect.
France, Germany, and the UK have joined the US in blaming Iran for the Saudi attacks. The Europeans have called on Iran to act more responsibly in line with terms of the nuclear deal which Trump has abandoned.
The general view in the UN is that the key to stabilizing the situation is for the US to return to the Iranian nuclear deal. If President Trump is not ready to return to the Iranian deal, then it is very unlikely that even close allies like the Europeans are going to support strong actions at the UN against the Iranians.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is scheduled to give his speech on Wednesday, in which he is expected to present a security plan for the Gulf region. Rouhani and Trump are both saying they don't intend to meet, but neither man has completely ruled it out. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, meanwhile, world leaders gathering at the UN General Assembly first met for a climate action summit aimed at discussing ways to reduce carbon emissions. Sadiq Ul Islam reports from the meeting where President Trump briefly joined leaders from some 60 countries despite his skepticism of climate science.
Protesters have gathered in cities around the world in recent days to demand that leaders take more aggressive action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and halt the rise of carbon in atmosphere. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said his generation has failed in responsibility to protect the planet.
Our world's forests are on fire. As we meet today, thick smog is choking tens of thousands of hectares of forest in Indonesia. And fires are still raging in the Amazon, afflicting millions of acres of rainforests.
Video of Brazil's Amazon forest burning this year have raised concerns over the vulnerability of natural areas that pull carbon from atmosphere. Mayor Arthur Virgilio Neto, whose city, Manaus, lies in the middle of the blazes, called for action.
Main leaders in the world, if they don't take seriously this problem, we have a planet that maybe will not worth to be inhabited by us. It will be unbearable. We cannot say yes to everything that comes from ideas of President Donald Trump. I think he is not understanding that his position is very bad, for the future of humanity.
The president has cast doubt on global warming and said efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions will hurt American workers and damage the fossil fuel industry. Despite his opposition, climate analyst David Wasko of World Resource Institute says climate policies continue in the United States at the local level.
Well, I think in the United States itself, we're continuing to see quite a substantial amount of action from cities, from states, and from business. That, although it doesn't make up for what the federal government isn't doing, it can take us quite a ways and do a significant amount of good.
The Trump administration backed out of Paris Climate Agreement and rolled back scores of regulations over clean air and water in the United States. Despite those actions, Trump insisted last month at G7 summit that he continues to think of himself as an environmentalist.
And I think I know more about the environment than most people. I want clean air, I want clean water, I want a wealthy country, I want a spectacular country with jobs, with pensions, with so many things.
Other countries that rely on fossil fuel for critical electricity needs are also speaking at the summit. India, Indonesia, and China all are building more coal plants to meet their rapidly rising energy needs. David Wasko says there is still time for countries to take concrete action, but the window is closing.
2020 is the time when countries need to come forward with stronger commitments under the Paris Agreement And they also have an opportunity to come forward with strategies for 2050, how we're going to get on a zero emissions pathway.
We're here as citizens of the planet.
Climate activists hope that they can convince governments to move faster to reduce carbon emissions and vote that they will keep protesting to keep the pressure on. At the United Nations, Saqib al-Islam, VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Israel prepares for bipartisan leadership. Zimbabwe's police have defied the courts in blocking a doctor's travel. The U.S. targets Venezuela's ties to Cuba with new sanctions. And Syria's opposition will meet with U.N. officials in New York at the General Assembly. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Britain's Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament for 5 weeks was unlawful and is void and of no effect. The court said in explaining the unanimous decision that Johnson's prevented Parliament from carrying out its role, holding the government to account. UK Supreme Court Judge Brenda Hale.
The court is bound to conclude, therefore, that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful because it had the effect of frustrating or preventing the ability of Parliament to carry out its constitutional functions without reasonable justification.
It highlighted the special nature of the timing of the suspension, which was supposed to last for 5 of the 8 weeks that remain before the deadline for Britain to exit the European Union. Here's activist Gina Miller celebrating the ruling.
Today is not a win for any individual or cause. It's a win for parliamentary sovereignty, the separation of powers, and the independence of our British courts. Today's ruling confirms that we are a nation governed by the rule of law. Laws that everyone, even the Prime Minister, is not above. Do not let the government play down the seriousness of the judgment today.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he respected the Supreme Court decision, but didn't agree with it. He pledged to carry out Brexit whether or not Britain has an agreement in place on the terms of its divorce with the EU.
As the law stands, we leave on October the 31st, and I'm very hopeful that we will get a deal. And I think what the people of the country want is to see parliamentarians coming together, working on in the national interest to get this thing done, and that's what we're going to do.
Parliament was due to be out until mid-October under the suspension, but the court ruling Tuesday said leaders can take immediate steps to return as soon as possible. Uganda is the latest country in Africa to revive its airline. East Africa now has 5 national carriers in all. However, a trade group predicts that most will lose money this year due to high fuel prices and the inability to sell all the tickets. For VOA, Mohamed Youssef reports from Nairobi.
If you are living in East Africa, you may soon have several airlines to choose from if you want to travel within the continent. Uganda is the latest to bring back its carrier after 30 years offline, joining its neighbors Tanzania, Kenya and Rwanda. Joseph Muvawala is the head of Uganda National Planning. He says the reasons behind bringing back the airline were economic.
Our citizens were losing close to $500 million US dollars in economic value in the cost of tickets. So we needed to increase the supply of air transport to reduce on the cost of tickets. At the same time, we as a country have a lot of exports that we are doing, mainly in food crops, which are perishable, and we needed a connection.
Meanwhile, Kenya policymakers are looking for ways to save their country's carrier, which has been losing millions of dollars. Some lawmakers want the national carrier to be run by the government. If that happens, the chairman of Kenya Airways, Michael Joseph, wants the carrier to appoint the top managers.
We do not want to create a situation that we had before, where you nationalize an airline and all it becomes is a department of government. The board of directors is loaded by friends of politicians, etc. We want to make sure that if we create a nationalized airline, that it will operate as a semi-autonomous airline and a semi-autonomous airport industry.
The International Air Transport Association, or IATA, predicts that African airlines will lose money this year, as in the previous 4 years. Andrew Matas is the IATA Deputy Chief Economist. He says all the African air carriers have high operating costs.
For example, we know that fuel costs for airlines within this part of the world are something like 35% higher than they are elsewhere in the world. So that's, fuel costs account for something like 25 to 30% of an airline's operating costs. So fuel costs are critical. When we think about costs, we also think about taxes and charges, and some of those, as I said, may be country-specific. So we need to look at and understand what's happening in that regard as well.
Ethiopia Airlines is the only carrier in Africa doing well, helped by the presence of the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa and Ethiopia's proximity to Asia. Muvawala says the other East African national carriers, including those of Tanzania and Rwanda, should consider creating one regional airline.
What the leaders of East Africa now have to do is to look at how do we then put all these resources together to make ourselves more powerful.
People in the East African community bloc are already free to move across borders and trade freely. Whether the countries can cooperate to form a regional airline remains to be seen. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And you're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives that inform, empower,
and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. A rare painting by the 13th century Italian master Cimabue was found in an elderly French woman's home northeast of Paris. As VOA's David Byrd reports, auctioneers expect it to fetch millions at auction next month.
The painting, entitled Christ Mocked, depicts Jesus surrounded by hostile crowds prior to his crucifixion. It's painted on a poplar wood panel with a background of gold paint and measures about 24 by 20 centimeters. Art expert Stéphane Pantin of the Turquin Gallery in Paris says the painting offers historians a missing piece in the puzzle that is art history.
This is a major discovery for the history of art. I often say art history is a huge puzzle. It lacks some pieces, and we found a piece with this painting. This piece fits perfectly in the puzzle we're trying to complete. We're talking about the start of Western painting. This painting was painted between 1270 and 1280, when Notre Dame was not even built.
A family in Compiègne, France, owned the painting, which was hanging above a hot plate between the dining room and the kitchen of their home. Stéphane Pantin says that an auctioneer discovered the work while doing an inventory of the house.
This little painting was hanging on the wall that separated the dining room and the kitchen. When Maître Wolfe questioned the owner, he said it was a small icon he'd had for a very long time, and it's not important.
However, once appraisers checked the painting's origin, its worth became clear. Tests using infrared light determined the artwork's provenance. It was from the 13th century and was a genuine Cimabue. The painting goes on sale October 27th, and Stéphane Pantin of the Turquin Gallery says it could sell for as much as 6 million euros.
Alors, aucun tableau de Cimabue n'est jamais passé en vente. Jamais.
No painting of Cimabue was ever for sale. The National Gallery of London in 2000 was scheduled to sell a painting, but it was withdrawn to be the subject of a private transaction. This artist is so important for the history of art, so this is the first time the painting will go to auction. We gave an estimate between 4 and 6 million euros, but who knows what a painting of Cimabue is worth.
Experts think the masterpiece is part of a polyptych that Cimabue painted around the end of the 13th century. Two other panels from the same work are on display at the Frick Collection in New York and the National Gallery in London. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Robert Hunter, the man behind the poetic and mystical words for many of the Grateful Dead's finest songs, has died at the age of 78. Hunter died Monday at his Northern California home with his wife Maureen by his side. The family did not release the cause of death. Although proficient on a number of instruments, including the guitar, violin, cello, and trumpet, Hunter never appeared on stage with the Grateful Dead during the group's 30-year run that ended with the 1995 death of lead guitarist Jerry Garcia, his principal songwriting partner. Some of the memorable Grateful songs he wrote the words to include It Must Have Been the Roses, Terrapin Station, The Days Between, Brown Eyed Woman, Jack Straw, Friend of the Devil, Box of Rain, and many, many more. Again, Robert Hunter has died at the age of 78. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. We used to play for silver, now we play for life. Once was born, once was blood at the corner of an eye. Now the die is shaking.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Israel announced they will cooperate on more development projects in the near future. On a recent trip to Israel, U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Mark Green signed a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, with Israel's Agency for International Development Cooperation, or MOSHAV. The MOU paves the way for greater collaboration between the U.S. and Israel in the developing world, including in Africa and Latin America, among other regions. In particular, the MOU establishes a framework for leveraging the American and Israeli private sectors to help increase employment opportunities and build resilient communities. It also aims to increase development cooperation in water, education, technology, science, agriculture, cybersecurity, and humanitarian assistance. Speaking at the MOU signing, Administrator Green said it was only natural for USAID and MOSHAV to work together. After all, he noted, we very much share the same vision. MOSHAV's vision to empower other nations to improve their own lives closely parallels USAID's goal of fostering self-reliance. We share the belief that our program should look forward to the day when they can end. We look forward to the day when people could take the knowledge and tools that we've offered and lead their own bright future. USAID and MOSHAV are already collaborating to strengthen food security across Africa, including Ethiopia, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. Indeed, last year, Israel joined America's Power Africa initiative, which aims to use market-based solutions to help bring electricity to marginalized areas of sub-Saharan Africa. MOSHAV and the Israeli government are able to provide specialized experience in agricultural development, food and water security. Indeed, Israel is a leader in the design and distribution of water conservation, desalinization, irrigation, and reuse technologies, among others. Together, said Administrator Green, USAID and Meshav will empower people, communities, and countries to improve their lives, to become self-reliant, and to lead their own bright futures.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. A